free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can find a list of past guests, download those interviews, see who's scheduled for upcoming shows, and if you're listening live, you can see the call-in numbers. We're joined this evening, June 15, 2009, by Bob Hargraves, who will be talking to us about thorium reactors, which can prove a much more clean and safe alternative to uranium-based nuclear reactors, as well as the possibility that they could be retrofitted into existing nuclear plants. Bob received a graduate degree in physics from Dartmouth, then spent his career in the IT industry. He served as a CEO at Boston Scientific doing medical devices, where he retired in 2000. More recently, he has been teaching courses at Dartmouth, continuing education in energy policy and environmental choices, rethinking nuclear power, which is what he'll be talking to us tonight, or along the lines of thorium reactors. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Glad to have you on. Well, you have done things in your career not along the lines of nuclear, more of a recent interest. What kind of got you thinking along the lines of nuclear and thorium in particular?
Well, about 5 years ago, I was in a situation where people were complaining about the cost of gasoline and energy independence and imported oil and the fact that we had troops in the Mideast defending our oil interests. And so I got a little bit frustrated with people who didn't look at other alternative energies. For a while, I got very interested in the pebble bed reactor, which is a kind of intrinsically safe reactor that has the advantage of having a high temperature that allows you to synthesize hydrocarbon fuel, so things like methanol or dimethyl ether that can be replacing gasoline. But then I gave a talk for several times, and people kept saying, well, what about the waste? And I got a little frustrated with that. The waste from that kind of reactor is about the same as from a normal reactor. So I thought I'd attack the subject more broadly, and I put together this course, which took me about 6 months to do. And I've given it now twice, and I learned a lot. You know, there's sort of a saying, if you don't know something, teach it. And that way you learn a lot in a hurry, because mm-hmm. you really have to be ahead of everything. So I did a lot of that, and I got very interested in the process in yet another kind of an advanced reactor, the liquid fluoride thorium reactor. The idea of thorium is that it's an alternative fuel to uranium in a way. Thorium isn't intrinsically fissile in itself. You know that in a nuclear reactor, the uranium-235 atoms fission or split apart, releasing neutrons that fission others and start a chain reaction and keep generating heat. But uranium-235 is only 0.7% of the uranium that's actually in natural uranium. It's mostly decayed away since the creation of the solar system. So, in a sense, there's not very much of it. Now, the thorium has the advantage that, to begin with, it's three times more plentiful than uranium on the Earth, and there is a scheme to irradiate thorium with neutrons in a nuclear reactor that converts that thorium to a form of uranium, uranium-233, which is a fissile fuel. So it's a good, plentiful source of energy for the U.S. and for the world. There's enough thorium just in Idaho to power the country for about a million years.
Well, it seems like a number I saw about how much thorium is available for energy would power the world for like 1,000 years or something like that.
Right, right. Now, in fact, this, we don't even have to mine much of it. It turns out that in the Manhattan Project, when people were looking at every possible energy source, they stockpiled a lot of the thorium in the deserts in the West on the grounds that it might be useful for something. So there's plenty to go around. I don't have
It's already been mined, so to speak?
Yeah, it's already been mined. It's sitting around in basically trailer trucks that are buried underground. Let me see if I can get the number I can't put my finger quite on the amount of it, but we're talking about decades worth of thorium that's already available.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'll be exploring more, you know, how it works and whatnot and the downsides, but why hasn't it been adopted already? Why is thorium taking a back burner
because uranium is adequate. I mean, it's adequate for the near term. It's adequate for another 10 or 50 years. One of the people we're worried about, the unavailability of uranium, let's say 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, when people thought that we were going to have so many nuclear reactors that we'd run out of uranium. Now, that sparked interest in reprocessing. That is, in uranium, there's a lot of U-238, right? 99.3% of it is U-238. And in a normal nuclear reactor, that uranium is transformed to plutonium, which is a fuel and is burned inside a reactor. And in a sense, you can keep that cycle up, potentially, to use up all that U-238. And if you were to do breeder reactors, such as where there were some experimental ones in the U.S. and there was the Phoenix reactors in France, there was the potential to create more uranium fuel that way. But the impetus for breeding additional fuel that way kind of disappeared when the U.S. stopped building nuclear reactors, three, 4 decades ago. And so there hasn't been much of a concern about running out of ordinary uranium fuel. So that's kind of the background.
Wasn't one of the reasons that it went in the direction of uranium as the primary fuel as opposed to thorium is that uranium was then able, one of the byproducts of the nuclear power process was weapons-grade uranium that could then be used for the stockpiling of nuclear weapons in the United States, you know, in the last few decades when we had the arms race and the Cold War and whatnot. Wasn't that one of the drivers for going in the direction that we did as opposed to the much less onerous or the much less, dirty, so to speak, in terms of the output? Thorium is much more benign, isn't it?
Yeah. At the very beginning of the World War II project, it was determined that they could make more plutonium faster with starting from uranium than they could make uranium starting from thorium, just because of the physics of the numbers of neutrons that are fissioned. And so basically all the research was just focused on that cycle, the uranium enrichment or uranium to plutonium in a reactor to make those two kinds of weapons. Thereafter, Rickover conceived of the idea of a nuclear submarine that could go for weeks or months without refueling or even surfacing. And eventually he was asked to create a land-based power plant, which he did. And in a sense, they had a technology that was adequate, and they didn't look any further at other technologies. It cost a lot of money to get to where they were, and they just kept using uranium.
So one of the things before we go to break I'd like to touch on briefly is, have there been any developments to commercial scale or to utility scale where it's actually online, a thorium reactor in the past? Wasn't there one in the over in Russia or something like that?
Well, let's see. There have been several reactors that used thorium. For example, the very first reactor that Bitcover built at Shippingport for a period of time was fueled with thorium because they realized that that was a rather inexpensive way to get uranium, to just put thorium in a nuclear reactor. And more recently, you're right, the Radkowski scheme of having thorium blankets around fissile seeds, it has been used and being tested now in Russia somewhere, I'm not sure where, to become a solid fuel that might work in a more or less standard light water reactor. So there have been several experiments. There was also a thorium reactor in Germany, a pebble bed scheme reactor that I think was 300 megawatts that ran for a decade or so using thorium blankets, if you will, in pebbles in the reactor itself.
So is that pretty much the limit of the actual implementation of thorium to date?
No. I think right after the break we ought to talk a little bit about what has happened in the Air Force. The Air Force generals were very jealous of Rickover's submarine that did not need refueling. This was the time of the Cold War, the Strategic Air Command, and they had to keep bombers flying over the Soviet Union or nearby just in case a war broke out. But they had to be continuously refueled or landed and taken off again.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone got the bright idea that if we could similarly build an engine for that kind of an airplane that was fueled by nuclear power somehow, the plane could just fly indefinitely, would not have to come down for refueling.
That was developed very far, wasn't it? That made it to prototype stage, didn't it?
Well, there were two that were made, right. One was the aircraft nuclear experiment, and I've forgotten exactly the dates on that, but say in, I think, 1954, they put their very first molten salt uranium fluoride reactor in operation at Oak Ridge. And then there again, thereafter, in 1965, they did another experiment, planning, in a sense, to wrap a thorium blanket around it to actually make it a thorium reactor. That project ran for about 4 years. But, it was never really completed to the full extent of a thorium reactor.
Yeah, we can pick that up after break. And also, at some point, did they have some kind of a liquid so you could actually ramp up and down? You didn't have this slow startup time that typical nuclear reactors have. They could govern it up and down really fast. We'll talk about that.
Okay, good.
I plugged the scan gauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The scan gauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The scan gauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at scangauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
For the most luxurious skin and body treatments, Glow Medical Spa is state-of-the-art. Combining safety and experience with the medical expertise of healthcare professionals, Glow Medical Spa is dedicated to the rejuvenation of your skin and body. We'll create the dramatic results you've wished for. For non-invasive treatment of scars, spider veins, body sculpting, skin tightening, hair removal, facials, and Botox, call Glow Medical Spa today. 623-334-GLOW. That's 623-334-4569.
I really wanted to stop using drugs.
I tried to quit.
I kept trying to quit.
I kept trying to quit.
I kept trying to quit, but it was just a matter of time before I'd be loaded again.
I felt like a hopeless, useless failure.
And then I picked up the phone.
Narcotics Anonymous, 24-hour helpline, 480-897-4636.
I was at the end of the road.
You know where I couldn't keep living with drugs?
I couldn't keep living with drugs.
And I thought I couldn't keep living without them.
Then I found N.A.
Narcotics Anonymous, 24-hour helpline, 480-897-4636, or visit us online at arizona-na.org.
We have an American soldier who was shot dead outside a recruiting station. So far, has the White House had a response to this or any statement?
Not one utterance.
This is unbelievable. And when they named the new Army Secretary, at that point, was the door not open for President Obama, the Commander-in-Chief, to make a statement? This after they rushed to the computers to put up a posting about the Tiller murder.
The Laura Ingraham Show. Your healthy radio addiction. Monday through Friday at 6 a.m. Free energy now.
Sterling Allen coming back at you. I'm in Eagle Mountain. We're talking this evening with Bob Hargraves, who has taken it upon himself to become learned about the whole thorium reactor field. He's done some continuing education courses on it at Dartmouth, and he's talking to us tonight about it. We were, before break, talking about the project that the Air Force had back about 1965-ish, where they were trying to have basically a nuclear-powered airline or a jet where they wouldn't have to land all the time and just keeping an eye on the Soviet Union. And if I remember right, as part of that project, they also had the ability to use nuclear power not in the slow startup that you typically have in a nuclear power plant where it takes a day to get a thing running and or more, and you don't just turn it off or turn it up and turn it down. It's kind of an on or off situation. They have this ability to actually, with a liquid fuel, a nuclear fuel, they could ramp up and ramp down the power very rapidly if, like you would need in a jet.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with how rapidly they could turn it up and down, but the idea of the liquid fuel was quite an innovation. The concept is that you develop a salt, and the salt is typically something like lithium or fluoride or beryllium fluoride salt that can basically have dissolved in it either thorium or uranium fluoride. So it's hot, but it's easily pumped around. So one of the things that you can do is add more fuel into the liquid or remove fission products from the liquid with chemical processes. Also, as the salt heats up, it expands, and a lot of it moves away from the area of the reactor where it would be critical. So its criticality is sort of self-adjusting. So it is true that that kind of reactor can generate more power simply by having the load put in place. So as the load is put in place, the heat is taken out, and it's cooled a bit, and the reaction rate goes up. So it does have that very nice capability to have a variable power output.
Let's talk about the safety of thorium. I understand there's a way that you can basically drain the reactor very easily to take out the fissile material, and so if you had any kind of a critical situation, you basically shut it down with no issue of runaway or possibility of runaway.
Right. Well, your readers probably have in mind, too, something like, let's say, two hemispheres of uranium that if you smash them together become a fissile or critical mass. And you can see by that that when the geometry of the shape of the fissile material that is far apart or together has a difference in its criticality, because when something is in, say, a spherical form, its neutrons are more likely to hit another uranium atom and cause a fission. So in the liquid fluoride reactor, the critical area is not quite a sphere typically, but it might be a squat cylinder. And if you get into some kind of trouble and you want to stop the reaction in an emergency way, you're right, you can just drain that salt into another tank, and that tank is probably a big flat pan. And because of the physical characteristic, that would not be a critical mass any longer, and that reaction would have to just stop all by itself. So almost all the new reactor designs want to be like that, that is to have criticality which is intrinsically under control, and have passive schemes to stop the reaction in case something happens. And the liquid fluoride thorium reactor has a variety of schemes like that keep it under control in a variety of bad circumstances.
Would you say that the liquid fluoride thorium reactor is the prevailing model for a thorium reactor?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say it's a competitor. There are two sort of approaches. One is the solid fuel approach, which is similar to what's done today in a typical light water, pressurized water reactor, boiling water reactor, where the enriched uranium fuel rods fission inside that reactor and make some plutonium, which also is burned. Now, that design is also amicable to a fuel form in which the fuel rods aren't just simply the two kinds of uranium, but might be a fissile material like plutonium, surrounded by a breeder material like thorium. So some research was done in the U.S. with thorium power, and also in one of the laboratories in Russia, whose name I don't know. It was invented by a guy named Radkowski, who was a pioneer in nuclear reactor development. So that's the one. The liquid fuel form and the solid fuel form.
Okay. Really quick, I'd like to go on a bit of a tangent. My understanding is that with nuclear power, you've got the radiation issue, and thorium also has a radiation byproduct, but that the decay time, the half-life, is much shorter for the thorium byproduct than it is for the uranium process that's presently being used.
It's right in one way and not in another. When in a nuclear reactor today, the uranium forms heavier metals like plutonium and even heavier metals. And those metals are radioactive. They decay even faster than uranium. So in that sense, they're dangerous to have around. They don't decay too fast. They decay in the order of magnitudes of tens or hundreds of thousands of years. But all reactors of any sort also have another kind of product called a fission product, and that is when you split the uranium atom into two smaller atoms of about half that size, you get things like krypton or xenon or cesium or stuff like that that is in an excited state and continues to decay. So it keeps getting to a more stable state. Those fission product decays are much more rapid typically, but we're talking, you know, tens or even a couple of hundred years before the stuff is really cool enough to not worry much about. So Yeah, it does have less radioactive waste, if you will, but you wouldn't notice it for 200 or 300 years. But that's a big help, because that means that if you do need to store that wasted or spent fuel, you only have to worry about a few centuries of it. You don't have to argue about whether the long-term storage requirement should be for 100,000 or a million years.
The one thing I'd like to do is to whet the appetite for after the bottom of the hour here, we're going to go to break again, is a comparison of the radioactivity of a nuclear plant compared to the radioactivity of a coal fire plant and the mining and whatnot is involved from beginning to end, which is more dangerous as a technology, nuclear or coal.
Okay.
When we come back from the break.
Live streaming audio on demand, 24 hours a day. Log on now at 1100kfnx.com. kfnx.com.
CNN Radio, I'm Andrew Spencer. The candidate who lost Iran's presidential election on Friday promises to challenge the results. Iranian immigrants like Rob Zahani say the re-election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is just a sign of his growing power.
I think what we're seeing is the ascendancy of Ahmadinejad and the military security forces. And with that in mind, it's going to be very difficult for Mr. Mousavi to sustain it without international support.
Mir Hossein Mousavi says he's willing to pay any cost to continue with his challenge, but that he doesn't expect it to succeed. President Barack Obama says rising health care costs are putting a strain on the federal budget. Without reform, he says the U.S. could go the way of GM. Stocks took a dive on Monday, the Dow dropping 187 points to fall back into the red for 2009. Concert ticket provider Live Nation is improving its no-service fee Wednesday, eliminating what many people have complained were hidden fees. This is CNN Radio.
A gradual end to this lovely double-digit weather the past couple of weeks. We could see 100 again as early as Wednesday, and then by Friday we'll probably be 105, and it is the official start today of the 2009 monsoon. Jim Howe, KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
Currently, in downtown Phoenix, it's 91 degrees.
This year, more than 186,000 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer. Worse yet, in the time it takes to play nine innings, prostate cancer kills nine men. This Father's Day week, team up with Major League Baseball and the Prostate Cancer Foundation to keep Dad in the game. Call 800-798-CURE and be part of the Prostate Cancer Foundation's Home Run Challenge. Again, 800-798-CURE. Make a pledge. Make a difference.
Do you owe back taxes, being audited? Whatever your tax-related problem, the former IRS agents and tax professionals at Taxmasters can help solve your tax problems today. Call 1-866-694-4020 or go to txmstr.com. Taxmasters will get between you and the IRS. They'll make sure they treat you fairly and treat you with respect. Call Taxmasters right now at 866-694-4020 or go to txmstr.com. Taxmasters will solve your tax problems.
Chatterbox Video Game Radio is the only completely live and public forum available to discuss current events in the video game industry, and we want you to join in the discussion.
Chatterbox Video Game Radio.
Every Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. only on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100.
Don't miss Imus in the Morning, Arizona's news talk leader. Imus in the Morning. Only on KFNX News Talk Radio 1100.
Free energy now.
We really want to change the world today.
Eagle Mountain, Utah.
We'll always take donations, that's for sure. Or some hard work volunteering.
Free Energy Now.
We really want to change the world today. We just want to help the world.
866-536-1100.
That's the toll-free call-in number if you're listening live, 866-536-1100. That's out of KFNX in Phoenix, Arizona, where we're broadcasting live. And if you're listening on the archive, sorry, you can't call in. We're talking tonight to Bob Hargraves, who is talking to us about thorium reactors in particular, nuclear reactions in general, nuclear reactors, which is where I'd like to start out this particular segment. I want to compare nuclear to coal in terms of its the dangers, even the nuclear components. I was reading something the other day was actually making a case that the nuclear power is much cleaner from a nuclear point of view than the nuclear stuff that's kicked up in the process of mining coal. Maybe talk about that for a second, Bob?
Yeah, we can talk about that just for a bit. Well, of course, an ordinary nuclear power plant is monitored very closely, and as a consequence, you wouldn't see much radiation outside the fence of a nuclear power plant, maybe an extra 5 millirems a year or something. A coal plant, on the other hand, burns coal, and the coal's got a little bit of granite in it, a little bit of rock, and that little bit of rock probably has a little bit of uranium or maybe radium or something in it. So it's true that some of the folks say, well, look, the smoke from a coal plant is more radioactive than the gases that may escape a nuclear plant. And that's true, but in both cases, the radiation levels are so low that there's no real danger to anybody. So it's sort of an advantage, but it's not a substantial one. On the other hand, burning coal creates not only just CO2, but it creates soot. Small particles on the order of 2.5 microns or less that cause cancer. And two or three studies have shown that there are about 24,000 deaths from cancer from breathing coal soot in the United States annually. UN thinks maybe 2 million worldwide from all kinds of soot, not just coal, but, for example, dung in the Southeast Asia and so on. So there's substantial air pollution that is associated with coal plants that is, in fact, quite dangerous. But we just haven't paid much attention to it. We also have to mine, you can imagine, hundreds of thousands of as much coal as we do uranium because the density of energy is so much less, and so there are a fair number of fatalities in the coal mining industry that just unfortunately happen just because there's so much coal that has to be mined.
When you talk about this low level of radiation that is basically negligible, let's talk for a second on a big tangent. We did a compilation the other day of recently, there's been in the news quite a bit about these products that are using recycled metals that turn out to have some radioactive components to them. Is that going to be something of a level that is going to be something we should be concerned about, or is that of the same, yes, it's radioactive, but no, it's not dangerous? What would be your input on that?
I'm sorry, I don't know exactly what the circumstance you're talking about when you talk about recycled metals that are radioactive.
Yeah, there was a story out of Scripps News Service the other day talking about how radioactive metals contaminants are found in some consumer products, and that everything from common kitchen cheese grater to cleaning chairs, women's handbags, sometimes are found to have radioactive material in them.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I bought myself a radiation counter once. I started trying to look at all those various sources, and I can't see much. But, for example, in your common household, you have a little radioactive material in your smoke detector. it's used to ionize the air. The amount of current that's conducted determines how much smoke is in the air. So it's small amounts are not, you know, anything to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk just about some of the advantages of that liquid fluoride thorium reactor.
Sure, let's hear you.
Because I feel that if we could replace, for example, a lot of the coal-burning power plants, not only would we save the CO2 emissions, we'd also save those soot emissions. And one of the nice things about the design of the liquid fluoride thorium reactor is it's scalable. You can have a rather small reactor. And I've been a proponent of one of about 100 megawatts in size that would basically be the same cost as an airplane, so that we could begin to make these things in a production line, in a factory, ship them to the site, assemble them, and begin through mass production to get the costs down. I have a sort of a target objective I try to talk to the engineers about, keeping that cost of power down to something under, you know, 3 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, that's the reason for that is that we want to be cost competitive with coal, because I tend to believe that we're not going to get anywhere with an international treaty to get China and India and Indonesia and every other place to stop burning coal, because that would stop their industrial progress. They need that energy to advance their standard of living and prosperity and so on. So I think if we could have a technology that was safe and inexpensive, we could undercut the tendency to burn fossil fuels all over the world. So that's one of the advantages I foresee in this technology, the potential for lower costs.
Okay. What would be another?
Another advantage is, and it's partly due to the design, and that is it runs at a much higher temperature. And since it is at a higher temperature, that means that your conversion ratio from thermal energy to electrical energy can be higher. In a typical coal or nuclear plant, only about a third of that thermal energy is able to be converted to electrical energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the determining factor is the sort of the ratio of the temperature of the gas or fluid going into and out of that reactor. If you can have that difference be higher, with efficient heat exchangers and a high temperature to begin with, then you can get those higher efficiencies. And that higher efficiency can be 50%. What it comes down to is that you don't need to basically get rid of so much excess heat. All those cooling towers around nuclear or coal plants are really, in a sense, throwing away two-thirds of the heat. Two-thirds of the heat coming out of the reactor, they can only convert a third of it to electrical power. With this kind of a plant with a high temperature, you could get that number up to half. Now, the advantage of that is, for a given size reactor, it turns out that you only need a cooling tower half the size, and we can perhaps use air cooling. That is, instead of having water-cooled towers, typically a big 1-gigawatt nuclear power plant or coal power plant today evaporates 20,000 gallons of water a minute. And there are a lot of places in the world where that much water just isn't available. So another advantage of that kind of a liquid fluoride thorium reactor is the air cooling means it can be sited in more places.
So because it wants to run at a higher temperature, you don't have to cool it down for it to be efficient.
Right. Well, almost. The efficiency of the conversion cycle is sort of like the temperature in minus the temperature out divided by the temperature in. So if you get that temperature in number up, you can make that difference bigger, and that makes the efficiency better. So
okay.
Yeah.
So Let's go back for a second to this. You're talking about going to a smaller scale, 100 megawatt cost of the airplane, go to a mass production type of scenario. How many years are we talking about to get to that point, to engineer that up and to crank it out and to get the people interested to be able to finance and et cetera? It seems like that would be a long process.
Well, in the current environment we're in, it would be a very long process. That's absolutely true. It depends upon how fast we really want to do it. Remember now, the Manhattan Project built an atomic weapon, having no experience in that process at all, in something like 3 years. We decided we wanted to go to the moon, and we did that in 8 years. So numbers like that are possible for big projects, particularly where we know so much.
So
I mean,
the biggest
in the case of the liquid fluoride
more
thorium reactor, not only do we have all the research and academic stuff, but we got two examples of them functioning back in the 70s and 80s. So
when we come back from break, let's talk about maybe how we could get to that point and what you see the necessary steps being to get to something along the lines of being that practical.
I'm Joe Battaglia, host of The American Advisor. Many investors have seen losses of as much as 50% in mutual funds and stocks, while other investors made money. Successful investors were properly diversified and owned gold. Gold tripled as our mutual funds fell. The net result was safety and protection of wealth for those who owned gold. Swiss giant UBS Bank is forecasting gold to rise to $2,500 in the next 5 years. So you can position yourself to recover losses and start profiting with gold. Call Goldline today to learn how you can put gold's amazing potential to work for you. 1-877-341-2646. You can benefit from owning gold. Call Goldline today. 1-877-341-2646. That's 1-877-341-COIN. For free information on investing in gold, call 1-877-341-2646 or 877-341-COIN. Call now and we'll send you a free CD and a free newsletter, a $25 value.
I plugged the ScanGauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The ScanGauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The ScanGauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at ScanGauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
Whenever called, they serve. They are often asked to put their lives on the line, whether it's keeping Americans safe from foreign threats or bringing relief from disasters here at home. Our soldiers prevail against all odds. These military sons and daughters have needed us in times past, and they need us today. We at ABC Plumbing and Reuter have brought you this message to ask for your support of our troops. Thank you.
Free energy, now!
Sterling Allen coming back at you. I'm here in Eagle Mountain, Utah, talking to Bob Hargraves, who is in New Hampshire tonight, over in the Eastern Time Zone. Appreciate him staying up late. It's 12:45 at night for him. We're talking tonight about thorium reactors in particular and nuclear in general. We were talking before we went to break about the process of taking this technology to where it'd be practical, getting down as much as 3 cents per kilowatt hour, where coal typically is in the range of 4 cents per kilowatt hour. And of course, that depends on where you live in the world. In Australia, they're as low as 2 cents per kilowatt hour. And I think up in Iceland, they're pretty cheap up there because they've got some really cheap geothermal up there. But typically, 3 cents is pushing the envelope on being cheaper than anything else available. To do that, we've got to bring the price down, and to do that, you've got to be into mass production. What is it going to take to get us there?
Well, I think there's two things that have to happen, and in my talk, I talk about a 10-year plan, really 2 5-year plans. The first 5-year plan, I believe, would have to be a government-subsidized R&D program, fully operational. We're talking about order of magnitude of $1 billion worth of development to bring the liquid fluoride thorium reactor to a prototype state, if you will. And I believe that R&D should be shared worldwide, should be public domain knowledge, because we want other countries to stop burning coal as well. But then I think it would take another 5-year period, frankly, to have all the GEs and Westinghouses and Arevas and Babcock and Wilcox-type companies learn how to actually put production lines together, do all the quality control and so on, so that we can begin to turn these out at a rate of maybe one a week or something of that nature. And that's the principle by which I say we can get the capital cost down to something like $2 a watt or $2,000 a kilowatt capability in order to get that cost per kilowatt hour down to, say, around 3 cents or less.
What are the chances that after 5 years of development, government subsidized $1 billion price tag, that you're going to end up with a boondoggle similar to the Tokamak project, $11 billion boondoggle that is more of a scientific mind game, if anything, than the practical embodiment?
Well, you're sort of right. I mean, that project is an exploratory process. It's like any science or research project. Here, this would be definitely a development project to make power stations that are affordable, reliable, and inexpensive to operate. That's kind of the thesis of the talk I've been giving. I put all that material together on a website, and in addition, Google most recently has made a copy of that talk with the slides and the video. And if you're interested in learning more about it, the name of the talk is Aim High, and the easiest way to find it is just to Google on the Internet for 3 words, Aim High Thorium, and you'll find the video and the book and the website and all that sort of thing. So, again, my idea here is simply to get people to realize that there are tremendous benefits of inexpensive energy that does not emit CO2. Those benefits are health of our citizens, the loss of global warming, and not only that, the prosperity of the developing world that desperately needs more energy in order to achieve a lifestyle such as we have here in the U.S. that includes lower birth rates. I didn't mention that earlier, but there's a strong correlation between prosperity, lower birth rates, and prosperity and energy availability. Mm-hmm. It's a key contributor to, for example, the ability of women to get education instead of carrying water around, that sort of thing. And it all eventually sifts out into lower birth rates. So I think it has a lot of benefits.
And so in today's economy where things are stretched so thin and investors are very reticent to put money into projects and governments are spent out of, they're already over budget. How do you foresee that $1 billion project for 5 years would be funded?
I have to say that I think it's too risky, it's too long-term of an investment horizon for a business to put a lot of money into. The GEs and the Westinghouses of the world will put billions of dollars into the existing Generation 3-plus nuclear plants, and they haven't got the return on those yet. And that's technology that's here and now and well understood. So they're going to be a little reticent to invest in something that's kind of just over the horizon. So I think we need to have national labs develop these kind of reactors, or at least do all the footwork to make sure that they're possible. We can't have another situation where business invests tons of money building reactors and plants and suddenly have them not opened due to some political whim.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think people are going to, that businesses are going to invest in these things at this stage. It's got to be government-sponsored, perhaps university or national lab, R&D.
And it's already going on along those lines. Isn't there already stuff along the lines of some thorium investigation by national laboratories already taking place?
Not that I know much about. I know that, you know, that an MIT professor and a Berkeley professor get some money from the government to do occasional papers a year, but you know, we're talking $100,000 or something. That's scale of investment in that technology at this point. The technologies that are sort of blessed by the DOE are the high-temperature gas reactor, the pebble bed reactor, if you will, or variants like that, and the sodium-cooled liquid fast breeder reactor, which is a project that was started, gosh, decades ago when we were talking about reprocessing fuel. Both are good projects, no question about it, but the fluoride reactor, I think, has the promise of being able to be developed and provide energy less expensively.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like, would you agree with the sentiment that thorium was overlooked a few decades ago because the Cold War was on and you had the byproduct of producing fuel for nuclear weapons from the uranium-based nuclear plants, and so they went away from thorium, and similar to the Stirling energy or the Stirling engine that was developed decades ago, it was kind of overlooked because of some timing issues, and it got a backseat, and therefore kind of lost the momentum, even though in some regards it's a superior technology, could arguably be to some of the other internal combustion engines. And that's, you know, bringing in another subject.
I understand your analogy, and that I think that's good. I would just only say one slight change to what you said, and that is it isn't that the nuclear reactors had a byproduct the capability to create nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons program was driving the whole industry. That was what was responsible for creating the diffusion plants that were used to separate the U-235. Those were enormously big projects. And once that capability was in place, it could be used, A, for weapons, B, for submarine fuel, and later on, C, for nuclear reactor fuel as well. So the technology was necessarily driven to make nuclear weapons, and that's why we picked the uranium-plutonium cycle in order to do that.
Is it fair to say, though, that, in other words, what you're saying is that the nuclear weapons was kind of the driver, and nuclear power was a derivative. And would you say that it's safe to say that the thorium industry would be the other way around? The thorium would be primarily energy and doesn't have a weapons component to it?
Well, I think you're right. That's true, that if you were, I mean, it's possible to make uranium from thorium, right? Because that's what happens inside the reactor. So in that sense, it's conceivable you could make weapons with it. In fact, that was one of the things they were experimenting with way back in the Manhattan Project. But if there were any development today in the thorium energy cycle, it would be oriented strictly toward nuclear power. And there's been a lot of work in the Energy from Thorium Forum to look at all the possible ways to make sure that that substance can't be diverted into nuclear weapons.
Before we wrap up here, do you want to give your contact information out, or can we get a hold of you through the Aim High presentation or other ways?
Yeah. No, you can write to me at robert.hargraves@gmail.com, or just go to the website, and you can get to the website by just Googling for Aim High Thorium. And you shouldn't have any problem sifting through some of that material and finding all you'd like.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on and talking about this subject, thorium and its possible future for cheap, safe energy. We wish you well in your pursuit to get people interested in this and promote that technology.
Okay, great. Well, I invite all you listeners to watch the one-hour video at Google there.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.